Hey y'all, it's Amber, and this is a friendly reminder that our podcast, The Sci-Fi Sci, is sponsored by listeners just like you. We just had Jazz A join the Patreon, and you can too. You can find the link to our Patreon in the show notes or the episode notes right below, and you can give literally like $1 a month, $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever you prefer to pledge. So go ahead and check out that link, and remember, at the end of the month, we always do book giveaways. Shout out to Morley, who just won our last book giveaway. Also, patrons, every time we do an interview, we include that visual Zoom link so that you can see me, Ben, and the author as we have that fun discussion. So you can check that out for today's interview as well. Also, if you're like, Amber, we just can't give right now. I ain't got no money. That's all right. We understand the finances are rough, so another way to support us is to give an Apple Podcast rating. It's completely free to share the news of The Sci-Fi Sci. Even if you hate the show, just leave some sort of feedback for us so that we can use that feedback and just be even better as we start to close out the year. I just checked the Apple Podcast rating from Aaron A. It says, so, so good. Love hearing you guys. That's it. That's all you have to leave. So be sure to leave an Apple Podcast rating or join our Patreon if you can. Now let's get started with the show. Welcome to The Sci-Fi Sci, under the Believe Podcast Network. It's a podcast about Black science fiction, fantasy, and staying on the same page of our marriage. Today is episode 51, and we have an interview, y'all, and it is going to be good. Trust me, trust me, trust me. We had so much fun speaking with this author. The author is Cadwell Turnbull. So let's talk a little bit about Cadwell, right? He is the winner of the 2014 NCSU Prize for Short Fiction, and he attended Clarion West in 2016. His short fiction has appeared in The Verge, Lightspeed, Nightmare, and Asimov's Science Fiction. His Asimov's short story, When the Rain Comes Back, made Barnes & Noble's Sci-Fi and Fantasy Short Fiction Roundup in April 2018. And the books that we're going to be talking about today in this spoiler-free episode are The Lesson, which we've recapped in the past, and his new book, No Gods, No Monsters, which is a part of a trilogy. Don't be fooled. I was fooled. I didn't know that. And I was like, wait, where's the rest of this story? And then I found out it was a trilogy. So be sure to get your copy of No Gods, No Monsters, and now sit back, relax, and enjoy this really great, just authentic, emotional interview with Cadwell Turnbull.
All right. So welcome to The Sci-Fi Sci. And we are here today with Cadwell Turnbull, author of the award-winning novel, The Lesson, and also author of the upcoming novel, No Gods, No Monsters, which is the first book that Amber and I ever received an advanced copy of. And there's nothing more badass. Yeah. Yeah. So there's nothing more badass than like reading an advanced reader edition out in public. And people are like, what are you reading? I'm like, you can't read this until September.
I have I have a few Instagram followers, and Ben was just like reading it in the background of one of my videos, and someone clocked it. They were like, how did you get a copy of that?
Snap.
You have a couple of people who are like, wait, is that his new book? When is that coming out? And I was like, relax. We're talking to him, so we got a copy. You'll be able to wait. So that was
fun. Oh, that's great. I started following you all on Instagram, and I just love your videos.
Oh, yay. Thank you
so much. Yeah, and I've been sharing them with my wife, and someone actually tagged me yesterday saying that you were reading The Lesson. Like, there was a video about you buying him a game that was, like, out of print.
Battlestar Galactica. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was like, oh, wow, very cool. Also, I just, you know, love that, like, little bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, in all seriousness, so, like, full disclosure, like, the night actually Amber went to New Orleans recently is also the night I started No Gods, No Monsters, and Amber was, like, trying to get freaky, like, the night she went out of town for, like, 3 days, and literally, like, Cadwell, like, you sex-blocked Amber, because I did not put this book down for like the first section. And I just love the structure.
Like, I'm reading about werewolves. Get away.
But in all seriousness, the way this No Gods and No Monsters is structured, right? It feels like each section is a novella. And then each chapter at moments feels like these little vignettes. And I was curious about like the intentionality behind that structure. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Okay, right. When I was working on The Lesson, you know, I was in grad school at the time. I started out with a short story, Let Them Talk. It was the one where Derek meets the where he's like working with the alien ambassador. That was my very first piece from that book. And I started writing other parts of the book that way. And I didn't know it was a novel yet. And my advisor at the time was like, this is probably a novel. And it took me a while for me to figure that out. And also novels are intimidating. So it was kind of my back way in. I was just exploring the world. And then I noticed that there were like these threads that were connecting and, you know, building towards an overarching narrative. And I started being intentional about that about a third of the way through. And so when I worked on No Gods, No Monsters, when I started, I was wondering, what if I tried to do this in a more intentional way? And so I structured it in this kind of independent stories that build into a larger story mosaic. And it's kind of become my thing. I think it's how my brain naturally works. And so I kind of build my stories out that way, multiple perspectives, and then they reach to a climax.
I thought you were about to say something. I really kind of want to talk about the multiple perspectives for a second, mm-hmm. because you write women incredibly well. It's a fun, so I'm not sure how much been shared with you about this podcast, but we do exclusively like Black sci-fi and fantasy, Black authors. And, you know, sometimes when it's like a male director, I'm just like, let me just, you know, let me like go in knowing that there might, or a male author, I'm like, there's probably not going to be a lot of female characters. And if they are, they're sort of like in the background. And I was just jaw on the floor from like the very first, I think you have more women characters in both books, and queer characters and asexual characters. So can you talk about how you have like kept that at the forefront of your writing? Because your women characters are just so dynamic and they're heroes. And it's so crazy for me to think, like there was a couple times I was like, did a man write this? Like, let me just confirm. So please, how many aunties, sisters, wives did you have to talk to like?
How many wives do you have, Padwell?
No, I really appreciate you saying that, because I personally worry about that all the time. You know, I do try to write perspectives that are different from mine. And my concern is always that, did I do that right? Is that actually working on the page? And honestly, I just grew up around a lot of women, you know, like that, you know, the women were around, you know, we had really strong, you know, matriarchs on both sides of my family. And, you know, my grandmother spoiled me rotten. So I just had a lot of, you know, interactions. My sister, you know, is a big part of my life. My mom is fantastic. And so I borrow a lot from the women around me. I have cousins and aunts that have just been around, and yeah, I try to bring that into the story as much as possible. Try to you know, make the women that I write, especially because I'm writing about women from the Virgin Islands, and women from the Virgin Islands can be a bit, and I've heard some readers comment on this, they seem a little bit like blunt, you know, a little rough.
Like characters in both stories got kicked out of the house. Right. Like, you know what, you just get out. And I was just like, that is so true. I have a cousin from St. Thomas. She married into the family. And she is like, wow. just get out of my face. Like very.
That's my sister to a T. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, this feels very Caribbean, very West Indian. So continue. I cut you off. But I got so excited when those women are just like, get out of here.
Or no, absolutely.
A woman's an ambassador. It's just so exciting.
Yeah, I just, you know, trying to be as accurate as I possibly can and represent, you know, bring in, you know, these women from my lives, you know, like Henrietta, the grandmother from The Lesson is like an amalgam of like, you know, a great aunt, you know, my grandmother, my mom, you know, she's a lot of people in one. And yeah, I just try real hard and hope for the best. And I, you know, I think that when I talk to people from back home, they're like, yeah, this reminds me of this is my grandmother. And I feel like I accomplished it. Like I did a good job when I hear that it feels accurate to the, you know, the St. Thomian experience specifically.
There's a nuance to this, So it's like mothers and then grandmothers. And there is something that Henrietta really resonated with me, because sometimes I go back and forth with my mom about like the content Ben and I are posting on social media. You know, she's all on the apps, and she just won't unfollow me. Just unfollow me, damn it. And so she's every other day texting me like, this is inappropriate, this is whatever. And we're at a point now where my grandmother is even sometimes being like, just leave her alone. Like, it's fine. Just let her do the thing. And I really, as Henrietta sort of had this eternal conflict of like being super religious and sort of like did the healing through a different measure and debating those two, it just really reminded me of my grandmother in that way, of being like, maybe like these strict beliefs I once held on to are not serving me in the same way, and I'm not going to speak out against them. But that just felt so nuanced, even though, you know, my family are all based in the US. But I just want to thank you for that. Like, the nuance of the generation skip even felt like, this is really like someone who intimately knows their like elders and ancestors. I just so appreciate that.
Thank you. Appreciate that. That means a lot to me.
Speaking of that, I do want to say, in the same vein, you handle all of your characters with such care. I'm a actor improviser, so we have a saying in acting that's like, protect the freak. So if somebody comes out in a scene and they're just being real crazy, you don't say something like, did you take your pills today, grandma? You should play along with whatever they're doing. And I think, right, in your stories, you do a really great job of like 3 pages in, here is the monster. And this monster has rights, and this monster has a whole experience. So can you talk a little bit about like how in some stories that monster is like under the bed, and we'll see them like in the second book or so, but in this book, it's like, here they are. Like, I'd love to hear what your thought process was behind that.
Right. I mean, I guess, you know, a big influence on No Gods, No Monsters was, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You know, I was a huge fan of that growing up. You know, I watched it every time it came on at, you know, in the evenings. I would stay up late and watch it. And then once, you know, there were box sets, I would get the box sets and watch them religiously. And, you know, in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the monsters weren't always out and about. They were definitely underground, and not everyone knew that they existed. But in Sunnydale in particular, you could kind of tell that the powers that be within the city knew that monsters were there, and they were kind of like, they would wink and nod at them, or kind of like turn the other way. And then you had, you know, the members of the Scooby-Doo gang who would hang out with some monsters, or some of them would become monsters. You know, Willow became a witch, and Oz was a werewolf, and, you know, Angel and Spike would kind of like meander in from time to time. And I was always just moved by those kind of intersectional stories where you would explore these human characters, but alongside characters that were monsters but were sympathetic, or they had their own struggles, or they had their own arcs. And that became like something that I wanted to do with the book. I wanted to take the monsters from under the bed, so to speak, and kind of give them some humanity, you know. And also because I was writing from, you know, about creatures from Caribbean folklore, I feel like the stories that we get about, you know, like the Sukuyant and the, you know, the Wuwu and Obia, they tend to be from, you know, the monsters as antagonist. And I was just very interested in like, well, you know, these monsters are Caribbean too. And what are their experiences as monsters being, you know, from those backgrounds and those identities? It just became important to me.
One of my favorite scenes in No Gods and No Monsters is because, and part of the reason it's my favorite is I spent 2 years in an intentional community, sort of like co-op, and we would have these like house meetings and bring up, you know, things that were said. And it was, I think, you know, everyone in the house was queer. And so we would, you know, talk about a lot of identity, you know, just a lot about our identities, and there was definitely conflict. And you have this scene where this co-op who does a lot of like political activism sort of discusses whether they're going to make the decision to include monsters in their political activism. And I was definitely like, trigger, like, just like because you have to have these intense conversations when you're living in community. If you're doing political organizing, mm-hmm. I was a union, delegate for a while, and it gets messy. It's just messy. And I feel like you captured the messiness really well. And then that meeting sort of takes a turn that I never had, which I will not spoil. Anyway. Can you talk a little bit about writing and including an intentional community, a co-op in your story, and what kind of research you did?
Okay. I'll tell the longer story. So when I was in my MFA, I was thinking about some science fiction story I wanted to write, and I was imagining, extrapolating some near future thing where a community, a marginalized community would like pool their resources together and create stability for themselves. And I was like, it would be great if that existed. Let me envision it. And then I looked it up, and it was, I found that, co-ops are a thing. There are intentional communities, as you mentioned, where they, they're attached to businesses and they create stability as a group and that sort of thing. And I just got really excited about that idea. And, one thing led to another. I started going to meetups, co-op meetups in Boston once I moved. And I got connected to a group called Grassroots Economic Organizing. They're a collective of people. Many of them are either co-op members or, co-op housing, co-op, worker-owned co-ops, that sort of thing. Or they were former members of co-ops. And they write about cooperatives, And so I attended a few meetings, joined a collective, and we would have conversations like this where we would discuss, the Send Collective in the book is very much inspired by GEO. And we would have conversations about making room, like co-ops, not cops, where we would address issues like police brutality, in the co-op movement. And then, there would be different people in that group, some of them older and white, some of them a little bit more conservative, some of them, really radical and queer, and not everyone would line up on the same, on the same stuff. They would disagree, and there would be debates, there'd be arguments, and we try to do them in a reasonable way that that check system is very much, it's real, you're asking to be on stack and then saying something and then saying check when you're done. But those things tend to, in the heat of the moment, sometimes occasionally fall apart when people are getting, a bit energetic about what they're talking about. And so I just wanted to represent that really well. And then I thought it would be really fun to just throw monsters into the mix. So yeah, that's where it comes from. And, It was a blast writing that scene, because I was like, how weird can I make this scene? It starts off with this very pretty low key, would be, boring to most people meeting, where they're talking about fundraising and then things just kind of go off the tracks.
That's one of my favorite scenes. I mean, talk about going off the tracks, no gods, no monsters. You're you throw in these huge monster world building, right? I'm like, this is great. And then you're like, let me just ranch this up. Let me throw in alternate worlds. And there's this great bit of you explain the parallel world theory, which is this idea where if you shoot an electron at two sort of slits, the electrons start going crazy, and the electron won't choose a direction until you look at it. And so it's almost as if the electron is living in two states at the same time. Did I explain that decently?
Yeah.
You did a much better job.
I had to reread that page 10 times. I was like,
it took me so long to be able to even explain that. A, understand what was being said, and then B, explain it well. Or explain it to the best of my ability. It's such a trippy thing, and it feels like magic. And I, it was one of those things where I was like, I'm going to make this magic. There's some plans for the series where that stuff will keep coming back up. And it was, it was really challenging to write that section.
I love it because what happens though is that you center this alternate world amidst two folk who are struggling with family members who have drug addiction. And I noticed like you do this a lot, Cadwell, where you present this fantastic speculative element, but then you hone in on like a relationship. And the speculative element sort of revolves around an intimate relationship. And it was just really like touching at moments. Like I have family members who struggle with drug addiction. And there are moments where I had to like definitely put this book down. Amber and I watched The Pharmacist during COVID, which is a Netflix series about drug addiction. And I just, it's really good. If you haven't seen it, definitely check it out.
I need to check it out.
It's really, really good. And I wanted to hear what kind of research you did about writing characters who are struggling with drug addiction, because I felt like you did it with a lot of care, a lot of intimacy, and it was really, really powerful.
That's a really good question. I did a bit of research, but to be honest, you know, the reason I, you know, brought that into the story was because I was bringing it from personal experience. That it was something that I was definitely pulling directly from life, and you know, having conversations with family members about, you know, people in our family that struggle with addiction. My dad struggled with addiction. And so a lot of that was just hitting really close to home. And I remember when I was doing the research for Hugh Everett's Many World Principle, I like read, you know, it was a biography. And all of those sections where they were talking about that stuff kind of just struck me. And it was a very thorough book. It was not just his life as a physicist, but his entire experience, his relationship with his mom, his relationship with his wife, his relationship with his children. And there was just so many parallels that I found to my own life, you know, this kind of like father figure that's a bit absent in a different way than my father was. But I found those connections, and, you know, his daughter struggling with addiction, I found that as a connection as well. And it just became, as I was working on that section in particular, that section actually was written before much of the book. And I tried to make those parallels as strong as possible, because I felt like that's the emotional core of the story. And then the many world stuff is the stuff around it. That's the way that I'm getting into this story.
Something that really hit home, a part of that is like my sister struggles and continues to struggle with addiction. And there are moments where, you know, she's gotten a job and she is not doing drugs, and you feel like, yes, this is good. And there's like a moment, oh my God, I'm getting a little emotional, but
with like Corey.
Yeah, like there's a moment in the book where, sorry, I thought I could get this question out.
Appreciate you, man.
All right, we're gonna edit all this out. No, there's a moment in the book where you have a character who, like, you know, puts on a suit and is like, "I'm gonna make the decision. This is the day," and like gets a job and is working, and just that up and down is captured so well. And I was like, I know this man has, like, it just felt so honest and so real. And to juxtapose this with like this fantastical element of many worlds, where you're thinking like there is a world in which, you know, the drugs were never tried. There is a world with like where the, you know, my sister's kids are with her, you know, there is that world. And it was just, it really put the many worlds theory and like almost a therapeutic practice, like thinking in the many worlds and a therapeutic practice. And I just thought that was like so powerful. That scene really hit. So read No Gods, No Monsters, folk. It is therapeutic. It is very therapeutic.
I appreciate you for saying that. Yeah, I've seen that, you know, there, you know, with my dad in particular, you know, just knowing that he was trying. When I was in high school, I had a conversation with someone that worked with my mom, but knew my dad pretty intimately, and she was a friend of his, but she also was struggling with addiction along the same time that he was. And this was, you know, during the era of the crack cocaine epidemic, and this was happening in the Virgin Islands as well, you know, not immune. And she was able to get sober, and she had, you know, had a, you know, a great job, and, you know, she saw me, she would say hi to me all the time. And then, you know, one day she was like, you know, I knew your dad, and I knew, you know, I was there when he was struggling, and I was struggling with him, and I got out. And I still feel like this kind of, there's this, because, you know, she was a good friend of his, you know, like survivor's guilt, like how did I get out and he didn't get out? But it's this kind of, I feel like it's that many worlds idea applied, right? It's like two people in, you know, relatively the same place. One of them finds their way out. It didn't really happen that way with my dad, but it was one of, you know, and she got like, you know, emotional when she was talking about it, and it, you know, it really stuck with me. It's one of those things, right? It's like, you know, I, in my own life, it's not addiction, but in my own life, there's things that I know that I want to get right, and I'm like, today I'm going to get this right. You know, just, you know, like I struggle with ADHD, for example, and sometimes it's hard for me to focus and get, you know, do the things that I need to do in a time frame that I need to do them. And I have all of these coping mechanisms for it. But every morning, it, you know, at the beginning of the day, I'm like, this is going to be the day that I get everything right. And, you know, it's so hard to do that. And I can't imagine what it's like to deal with addiction, you know, and have to struggle against it. And each day is a new struggle. It's not, you can beat a day, and then the next day gets you. And it's one of those things where I wanted to approach it with empathy. I have really complicated feelings towards my father. But it was a healing experience for me writing that, because I, you know, try to empathize with what that would be like from, you know, from Corey's perspective. And the fact that Cal still loves his brother, even though his brother is, you know, doing all of these things that he doesn't agree with. And, you know, he's scared for his brother. And you can see moments where his brother is trying. And he's just, you know, these things.
Yeah.
Well, I had a horrible next question, but I'm just going to rip the Band-Aid off. Let me give you a little context. I really appreciate stakes. I appreciate high stakes. And so I hate when I watch a movie and no one dies, even though, or a character has a cold and they don't die.
I'm like, and no one is struggling with a drug addiction. It's the worst.
No, I make it trauma porn. Yeah. It's like, here you go watching your trauma porn. But you are not afraid to kill characters. You're like, high stakes character. I don't want to spoil anything, but I remember the lesson. I was like, oh, that person's not coming back. Okay, next chapter. And so I would love to talk about how you sort of have navigated that, because like do you start a project thinking like, Ben and I are really good. Ben has read everything in the world. So whenever we watch a movie or something, he's like, oh, these three people are going to die, or this person's going to die. It's already set up that way. And either they die or they don't. But every death that I thought was going to happen, like some of those happened and then others happened. So I would love to hear, like, do you go into a story thinking, I'm going to kill this person? Or do you write it and you're just like, well, now that I've built this world, this is what happens at this protest. This is what happens on this island. I'd love to hear like how you go into that process as a writer.
Right. I want to say first, right, there is a, you know, big difference between trauma porn, like relishing in, you know, violence and people dying, and trying to be real about how the world works, you know, like, you know, there's a character in The Lesson that dies. And one of the reasons why I think it was important for that character to die is because I was very interested in like, what if you have goals? Again, you know, this goes back to the conversation around like struggling with addiction. What if you have goals for your life or for your community and you try to make them happen and you just don't make it because that's how it works, right? We've seen this with, you know, great Black leaders. We've seen this with, you know, people like MLK and Malcolm X and Freddie Hampton, where you see all of that promise and, you know, all of that potential there and it's dashed because the world is really complicated and messy. And it to me, that's important too when talking about or exploring social movements and conflicts in the social sphere. You have to be realistic about that fact that it's dangerous and you can't write the story. And, you know, I sometimes get frustrated with stories where there's a single protagonist that just does everything just perfectly. Everything lines up and all of these like improbable things happen that they just dance through because they just have, they're the luckiest person on the planet. And, yes, you know,
this is what I'm talking about right here.
Right.
I hate that.
Right. Oh. In the real world, that doesn't happen. Right. And, you know, it's different watching an action movie. Like I can watch the Fast franchise and just enjoy it. Just turn my brain off and just be like, you know, yeah, sure. He got caught by a car. That happens. But, when I'm writing a story that I want to feel real, I feel like those stakes have to be there. There has to be an amount of danger or else it doesn't make sense on the character level. What these characters are afraid or they're worried or they're concerned. They care about people around them and they want to protect them. And that happens through loss. You experience, you know, danger in the world and you incorporate that into your activism, into your work, into the way that you love people. And that you have to be able to see that in the stories that you tell as well, or the stories that you read. And so, yeah, I do try to, you know, I felt like with the lesson in particular, I felt like I overdid it. there was times over...
The bodies were piling up.
Right, right. there was times between when the book was finished and before the book came out, you know, in its arc era, where I would just wake up at some nights, like in a cold sweat, like, oh my God, I killed so many people in this book. Why did I do that? You know, and then I, you know, had all kinds of thoughts about like, you know, this is St. Thomas, this is my community. You know, I felt all kinds of guilt as if they were real. Mm. They're, you know, they're fictional characters, but I'm like, that's a lot of people, you know, and what am I saying? You know, and I tried to end the lesson, you know, on a hopeful note. Like I definitely see it as, you know, tragedy and hope, but it weighed on me. And when I started writing Ogas No Monsters, I was like, well, people are going to die. But I tried to temper that. I was like, I'm not going to kill as many people this time. it's a trilogy. So who knows what's going to happen in the next two. But yeah, some of it I do, to answer your question, some of it I do because it makes story sense or it makes character sense. Or it's saying something thematically that I think is really important to say. Occasionally, I'm writing a character and I realize that they're going to die. And then there are other characters that I set up to die from the beginning. I'm like, they're going to die because I'm modeling them off of someone or I'm thinking of what role they have within the story. And the goal there is to still create that character and flesh them out and make them a full human and give that death meaning. Like, I feel like I try to avoid meaningless death. You know, I feel like each death in the story has weight and value. And I feel like that's different than, you know, trauma porn or just like killing like people off for the sake of it. Right. Yeah. So it's a balancing act of those two things. Like, recognizing that you have to kill people die. And then recognizing that if you're going to do that, it can't be cheap.
On the topic of messiness, you do have a lot of messy relationships in your stories. Let's actually talk about discipline. Amber, you want to share that story where you talk back to your mama and she, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm a Black child, so of course I've gotten into rumbles and tumbles with my parents.
Well, I got spanked all the time growing up. You know where I'm going with this?
Same.
Well,
yeah, you know? I know.
So you want to share that story when you were in the kitchen?
It's not that elaborate. Well, please don't cancel my mom, whoever's listening up. One time I was just like, I was 16 and I think I was asking my mom for help with something. And she was like, I'm not doing this right now, whatever. And I put my hand on her shoulder being like, no, I need help with this. And she I had a reflex, if you will, and just laid my ass out. So I was like, what is happening? Yeah, that's the story.
Yeah, I mean,
without getting her like arrested. That's
well, and that's the thing is that, you know, your mother is like the sweetest, kindest person. And, you know, Amber and I, we've talked a lot, you know, if we, you know, when we have kids, we read All About Love by Bell Hooks. I don't know if you've ever read it. It's really good. It sort of changed how we approach like corporal punishment or spanking. And you have a really incredible scene where there's a moment that Amber experienced, and you have a scene like that in No Gods and No Monsters, and you approach it, you sort of have this exploration of corporal punishment and, you know, decisions to spank or not spank. And I just thought it was done really, really well. And also like exploring what that means if you are, you know, an immigrant and you're making these decisions in a context that is different than yours. And so can you talk a little bit about that exploration of corporal punishment and spanking and all that good stuff?
Yeah, sure. I want to be careful too, because yeah, people get canceled out here for this stuff. And I want to like blast my
book hasn't even dropped yet.
Right. Family members. No, but I have experienced that form of discipline. I think a lot of people from Black families have people of color, people from the Caribbean, for sure. That's the way, you know, that's how you train your kids up. But I luckily had a mom, I say this very carefully, I luckily had a mom that was, didn't want that for her kids, you know, like she had some experiences with my grandmother, who was very much pro, you know, disciplining children. And sometimes in ways that, you know, later on was I, you know, hearing the stories, I was like, that's traumatic, you know, like, And so, you know, she wanted that to not be how she treated her kids. But, you know, we were terrorists. Like, you know, my brother in particular, I was the kid that wasn't necessarily a terror, but I would like argue. I always had like a rationale. And I'm like, here's why you being mad at me is wrong, you know, you know. And so I would just debate my mom, and my mom would just be exasperated with me.
You've written two novels, right?
Right.
Of course, you have something to say.
These are both arguments with my mom. We weren't always the best children, and sometimes we would test my mom's patience, and you know, she didn't always like, you know, follow through on her, you know, no corporal punishment rule. I'll put it that way. And I think that's really interesting. You know, like I think that that's an interesting thing to explore with parents who have the best intentions at heart, but, you know, their kids test them. And, you know, Rebecca is not the easiest daughter, you know, and there's a character, her father was having a particularly bad day and things happened. And it becomes this like dark cloud over the rest of their relationship, partly because they had chosen not to do this. You know, it was like they were not used to that at all. Even though, you know, for Caribbean parents, that is a norm. Like most people would be like, what, he hit you once, you know, like,
right. Like, you can count on one hand how many times you get your pass.
It's like, come on. This is not an issue. But because they had not done it, because they cared about that, you know, so much, and they, you know, refrained from it, when it did happen, out of anger, out of frustration, out of a particularly vulnerable moment, it became like a big thing in the family. And I found that interesting, like more than the exploration of parents that just decide that they're going to beat their kids all the time, or parents that don't at all, that like, what happens if you choose not to do it, but because of, you know, situations or a context, or because of, you know, cultural background, even, you slip up, you know, and how to explore that in a way that doesn't absolve the father, but also doesn't paint him as a villain either. You know, I was trying really hard to not be like, corporal punishment is okay, everyone. But also, you know, say, I think in, you know, in this case, it's complicated. And I think that, you know, that relationship, Rebecca feeling some remorse for not, you know, forgiving him, I think is reasonable from her perspective. And, you know, it doesn't strike me as, I'm just interested in like creating these gray areas and exploring them and creating moments for empathy. And it's one of those things. It's one of those things that, yeah. I've experienced, as I'm sure a lot of people have, both of you have. And, you know, I still love my mom to death. You know, I love my grandmother, even though I knew I
had to like pull my own switch up.
Right. You know, and, you know, talking about, I feel like this is like therapy about my dad today. Talking about my dad again. There's things I know about him that are unforgivable, you know? And then there's things that I experienced, you know, firsthand. But there's also things I know about him that makes me, you know, definitely at moments like this where I'm doing something and I'm proud of it, I wish he was here. Mm. Like, I do have fond memories of like going to Burger King and eating ice cream with him.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's one of those things, like you try to create people that are flawed and you try to give them room, you know, to be flawed and love them anyway.
Yeah. I definitely see that humanity in your characters. I want to talk a little bit about St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, because I've been to St. Croix once, so I'm obviously an expert. you know those people. But I especially with the lesson, of course, I really, like, you put us on the island with everything from like drinking the cruising rum to the blackouts. I was like, oh, like that is so, like, I'm sure you probably read other people who set their stories in St. Thomas and don't include those elements, and you can probably like clock it immediately. You're like, this is not, like, did you stay on a resort when you went there or whatever? So I'd love to hear how you have potentially seen, you know, U.S. Virgin Island stories written by people who aren't there. And I'd love to hear about writing about Boston. So we're all of that.
Okay.
What kind of question I just made, but.
No. I hear you. Yeah. You know, surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, there are not a lot of descriptions of the Virgin Islands in fiction. And the ones that I've read, and maybe I've just done a good job of avoiding the ones that, the bad ones, but the ones that I've read are people from the Virgin Islands writing about the Virgin Islands. Great. And they tend to be, you know, they tend to feel pretty real and pretty accurate, you know, but, you know, there's also like this temptation, to think that one rendering of the Virgin Islands is more accurate than another, or that it can represent the whole thing. There's different St. Thomases, if that makes sense. You know, like, you know, I'm writing from a very, you know, my mom was a single mother, but she had a government job. So we were we struggled, but we were better off than some of my friends, you know? And then we weren't as well off as some of my other friends, you know? And so like anyone writing about any of those different Virgin Islands will depict it differently. You know, it would feel different, I think, those stories. But, you know, it became, as I was revising the lesson, it became important to represent the place. I fought it for a while because I would workshop pieces and they would be like, you should describe this more. And I was like, I don't want to exotify my home. Like I want it, it's my home. It's normal. I want it to feel normal, you know, to me when I read it, or, you know, but it became, you know, the way that I got around that, or the way that I, you know, thought about it differently was I realized, well, those things that make it home, they need to be on the page, you know? So, you know, because there's a reason when I go home, like I feel like this pressure on my back ease. And that's just, you know, the sun, the way that it smells, the way that it looks, you know, the way that people sound. And that needs to be on the page too. Like if the Virgin Islands is a character, you have to describe it. And so, you know, I try to do that to the best of my ability. Boston was different. You know, I've been living here, you know, I actually, you know, moved down to Raleigh for a teaching job, but I'm here now because my wife is still here finishing up a degree. And when I was writing about St. Thomas, I kind of took for granted that I knew the place. And then I did a lot of research and realized that there was a ton of things I didn't know, but I still felt like I knew it enough to talk about it well, you know what I mean? Boston, everywhere else that I've lived, I felt like a tourist. And so it was difficult for me to gain the courage to actually write about, you know, Somerville, you know, like my neighborhood here, and Boston and the Boston Commons. To write a scene that is set in the Boston Commons felt like really like arrogant to me. It's like, how, like, you're not from here.
White people do this all the time, Cadwell. So we do this all the time. We write about places we know nothing about.
Right. I think from the other side, because you know what it's like for someone to misrepresent place for you, you tend to be a lot careful, you know, worried or concerned. I just remember something I wanted to mention. The only depiction of the Virgin Islands that I can remember outside of College Hill, which was like a BET show, kind of like fashioned off of the real world, there was a season in St. Thomas, was Weekend at Bernie's. I think it was the second one. Do you know Weekend at Bernie's? You know,
there's like a dance.
He's dead. It's a dead man. And he's dead the entire time, but he kind of takes on like this half life where he can kind of walk, and it's weird. I cannot even explain it, but some of it is set in the Virgin Islands of that time. And it's really weird seeing like the streets from that time. That, you know, that's the only good one I can point to. Anyway. It was different writing about Boston. I did the same things that I did when I was writing about St. Thomas, though. I kind of like visited everywhere that I was writing about, and I took pictures, and I made sure that I got the details right, at least, even if I felt like I'm an imposter doing so.
Yeah, I really appreciate. So, you know, No Guys, No Monsters doesn't have the audiobook yet. So, mm-hmm. But I typically read a book and listen to the audio at the same time.
Me too. It's the best.
All the time, they're like, why would you listen to both? Like, do one or the other? I'm like, no, because it, and so it was really. Like,
Amber ends up pronouncing everything correctly too. Like, yes. I will mispronounce right. things, but because she listened to the audio book, she's like, no, you said it wrong. I was like,
oh. Or when they get it. Well, I think also as an actor and a voice actor, I really appreciate when they choose a actor that can speak or with the dialogue, with the accent and stuff. So I really mm-hmm. like those elements. And so I found like myself in trying to do it in my head and No Guys, No Monsters. But there were some words where I was like, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this. What's the one that was like, I think it's like P-A-H-N-A-H or something.
Pana.
I remember. Is that like the N word for the Caribbean? I was thinking like, how would you describe that word?
Sort of. So it doesn't have, well, you know, even N-word with the A at the end has like a certain level of baggage. You know, you can, you know, Black people will argue about whether or not you should even use it that way and blah, blah, blah. Pana is like dude, like it's like guy.
Got it. You know, like, thinking, I was like, oh, maybe this is a word like, how we use like nigga this, nigga that. I was like, oh, maybe mm-hmm. this is the Caribbean version of that. Like, I remember trying to do that work in my head, but I thank you for confirming that. I was like, But no, I really liked listening to the, what. So I was curious, like, as this goes into production, are you going to get like a Boston accent person or a Caribbean person or I don't know.
No.
You're like, I don't touch any of that stuff.
I wish it was, it's so complicated. This stuff is so hard. Like when we did the lesson, we didn't find anybody that was from the St. Thomas specifically. We just found people that could reference the accent relatively speaking, because they have a Caribbean background and they have Caribbean family and they can do the Caribbean accent. And we, for this one, we have, a voice actor, Dion Graham. He's pretty amazing. He's really good with accents. So we'll see what he does with the Boston accent. I don't know what he'll do. I don't know what he'll do with the St. Thomas accent, but I wish it was like, and this was a thing, I was doing an event with some other Caribbean writers and we were talking about it, where there's just not enough Caribbean narrators, you know, and that is a thing that is, you know, complicated and fraught. You really want, like, ideally I would want from someone from St. Thomas playing, you know, Cal and telling the story from that perspective, but it's just that's not going to happen. Not the way we would hope.
I got you. Yeah. I'm from Georgia. So whenever a book is set in Georgia, I can pretty much clock it right away. I'm like, this thing or not, or you can tell like, oh, you did your research and then you got the narrator to have a Southern drawl. Like, so it does matter. Like it's cause it's a whole experience. So, but I totally understand like the lack of, or the lack of access to like all of this stuff in different places. Yeah.
Right. You get it both ways. I was talking to family members about it. And I was like, what do you think about it? I know it's not St. Thomas. It's like, they were like, close enough, you know?
They're like, we're just so proud of you. You're
Yeah.
Who cares?
It's like, it's fine. It's done, whatever. And then you'd go, you know, in that conversation I was having with the other authors, they're definitely like frustrated by it, you know? And some people are like, that is not the St. Thomas accent. But most people, because they recognize how difficult it is to find the right narrator from the right place in the, you know, all of these islands are small places and there's so many of them. The thing that is, that they, you won't get away with is if the person is talking and it sounds too Jamaican. And that's not no shade against Jamaica, but that's just because everything kind of gets flattened to Jamaica because of how people see the Caribbean. They think it's all the same. And so
yeah, it's like
you try to get
Jamaica in their brain. Yeah.
Right. Like a Caribbean standard is the you know, way to go. And yeah, you're going to be borrowing from different dialects when you do that. But if it sounds too Jamaican, I think that's the thing that will frustrate someone from, you know, the Virgin Islands, particularly listening to the audiobook.
Well, we are all out of time. Is there any other projects you have working on? I know you said this is going to be a trilogy. What other things do we have to look forward to?
Yeah, so right now, I did No Gods, No Monsters. And I've been working on the second book, We Are the Crisis. And it's been So No Gods, No Monsters was challenging because it was my second book. As I said, like the lesson kind of came together almost by accident. And so I was like, could I actually pull this off intentionally? And I managed it, but now I'm trying to do a follow-up in a trilogy, and I'm like, this needs to be good. This needs to, follow the first one well and set up the third. And so I've been like, hard at work trying to make sure that, the stuff is right there. And so yeah, that's my main thing. I have a project that's they haven't announced it yet, but we're very close to wrapping up with Realm. They're like an audio narrative company. They kind of build themselves as a like the HBO of audio, storytelling. And it's generally speaking, it's about time travel in Tulsa, specifically. Yeah, you get it.
Yeah, I think I
Yeah,
already know.
I'm very excited about it. And I, a couple stories coming out in the fall, a couple stories I need to write for the fall. I actually I Nisi Shaw, she does her own work, but she also is a an editor. And so she's doing the second volume to the New Suns
Good sense.
anthology.
Oh,
Yeah,
yeah.
and I gotta write that story.
Sure do.
Yeah. And recently, I had a story in the Black Panther anthology, Tales of Wakanda. Yeah, that's really what I'm up to. And then, hopefully seeing, hopefully things are going to be moving forward with the lesson with EMC. Fingers crossed on that.
We're gonna put all those links. Tales of Wakanda, we'll put that inside the description, and then the HBO of audio Realm, you said. We'll be looking forward to that. Awesome.
Oh, get some sleep. You are busy.
Oh my gosh. I keep waiting for the time when the things slow down. This is just how it is though.
No, 2020 is
Yeah.
not your year.
No.
2021. What year is it? Yeah, maybe next year you'll get some rest and a vacation because you're so
It
busy. I love it.
is my hope. Yeah, and I just started a teaching job too, which is the other thing. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, no. And I love it, but it's also like my whole 2020, I started it during the pandemic. It was just like a vacuum of time. It was just a lot of, just getting used to things, but also not being able to adequately get used to things because a pandemic was happening, and trying to get writing done at the same time and keep up with this stuff with the book. And yeah, the summer has been catch up. Maybe next summer will be
Be a good
like
time to find a
go
pool.
home, go to St. Thomas and hang out at the beach all day.
Well, we want to thank you so much for spending your morning with us and letting us pick
Absolutely.
your brain. And thank you just for being so vulnerable and sharing about everything with your father and your family. We really appreciate it.
So it's always great to talk to people that are excited, as excited or, reasonably excited about your work as you are. And so I really appreciate you all just taking the time to read both books and ask me all of these really great questions, some deep questions that I've never, had the privilege of, answering before. And, just really appreciate you both.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Sci-Fi Side Podcast. Up next is episode 52. Y'all know what that means. We are celebrating 1 year of this podcast by listening to listeners like you and answering y'all's questions. So we're going to do a Q&A. So be sure to submit the rest of your questions using the link in the episode notes. And we will see y'all next week to kick off our 1 year celebration. Bye, y'all.